Good morning, Your Honors. Doug Walton, counsel for the defendant. If it may please the court, we're here on the issue of whether there was sufficient evidence to convict the defendant, Dale Sanders, of conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute MDMA, or hereinafter we'll call it ecstasy, in violation of 21 U.S.C. 841A1 and, of course, 851. Now, Your Honors, we have contended from the beginning that this was a buy-sell relationship and not a conspiracy. And to help the court with our argument, we will base that upon the Rivera case, which in 2001, this court reversed the same district court's conviction of a defendant in a very similar case. In this case at bar, all the transactions occurred in Louisville, Kentucky. That's where Dale Sanders lived, and that's where the co-conspirator, alleged co-conspirator, Zach Wilson, traveled to purchase the narcotics. If we look at the trust...
I don't believe that ecstasy is a narcotic.
Well, a controlled substance then, Your Honor. Thank you.
Narcotic is a central nervous system depressant. Ecstasy is a stimulant.
Correct, sir. Well, nonetheless, Your Honor, it is a controlled substance. And in the Rivera case, there was a set of, if you will, criteria, none of which is dispositive, that the court relied upon to determine whether or not a conspiracy existed. The first factor was whether or not, or the length of the relationship between the parties.
I think we know all of these factors, but we have a bench trial here.
Yes, we do.
The district judge made findings, and the only question is whether they're clearly erroneous.
Yes, sir.
Why are they clearly erroneous?
Your Honor, they are completely inconsistent with this court's findings in Rivera, in which court was reversed.
The question is, why are they clearly erroneous on these facts?
Your Honor, in this case, one of the issues we have to look at here is whether or not there was any fronting. There was no fronting between the parties. Mr. Sanders sold cash on the barrelhead, dollar for drugs, to Mr. Wilson. Secondly, Your Honor, the method of payment, of course, was just cash on the barrelhead. There was no credit taking place. So there's no level of trust between them. The court looked at the analysis from Rivera to come to its conclusion.
Yeah, but he found neither of those existed.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
He acknowledged there's no fronting.
That is acknowledged, yes.
And I don't know what the other part.
Well, the judge in Judge Young in the district court basically said, well, there was a standard method of payment because it was cash and he was paying for a certain amount of pills. But if we look at the Rivera case, Your Honors, we're looking at kilo transactions, and he was offered a discount. That is, Mr. Harden in the Rivera case was offered a discount for greater purchases. Same thing in this case. But there is no indicia that Mr. Sanders had, if you will excuse the colloquy, a dog in the fight with regards to Mr. Wilson's distribution of the drugs. And again, the Rivera case says that even knowledge of the purchaser's future intentions to distribute the drugs is not dispositive of a conspiratorial relationship. Furthermore, Your Honor, the quantity, even if the quantity is greatly in excess of what is possible for human consumption, is not dispositive of a conspiratorial relationship. So there is no indicia here that there was sufficient evidence to show, with regards to that part of the test, that Mr. Sanders was a conspirator. The other issue here, Your Honors, is the level of mutual trust. If you parallel the Rivera case to the case at bar, the transactions that took place in California with Rivera took place at his home. 3 out of 4 did. Only 2 took place at Mr. Sanders' home. The others they met at various locations, a gas station, a hotel, and at a pool hall. Mr. Rivera, in the Rivera case, did not count the money until the last transaction. Again, Your Honor, mirror image. Mr. Sanders counted the money on the last transaction. So, if we move on to the other issue here, yes.
Why do you care?
What do I care?
Why do you care, exactly? Your argument, as I understand it, is that after hearing this evidence, the judge should have convicted your client of distributing drugs rather than of conspiring to distribute drugs.
Actually, Judge...
But I can't see any difference between the two convictions.
I respectfully beg to differ with the court. I raised an issue in trial.
If you would stand at the lectern.
Okay, thank you. I raised an issue at trial that this court was not the proper venue, that they did not have jurisdiction over this case. And I mentioned that in my brief, although it's not stated in my issues. Of course, the government in their brief says that I have waived that argument, but that is not true. U.S. versus Cotton says that because subject matter jurisdiction involves a court's power to hear a case and this and thus can never be waived.
Related to subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, it is.
Is this the answer to the question why you care? That is, you think that if this were a substantive prosecution, there would be no venue?
Could you please clarify that question for me, Your Honor?
I'm trying to figure out whether I can clarify your answer. My question is why you care. The penalties for conspiracy to distribute drugs and for distributing drugs are identical. Your client essentially concedes that he distributed drugs. That's the substantive conviction. I can't figure out why you care whether this conviction is labeled conspiracy or distribution.
Your Honor, simply put, my client did not engage in any overt acts in the Southern District of Indiana which would give that court venue or jurisdiction over him to prosecute him for that offense. He is prosecutable in Kentucky.
Your answer, if I understand it, is you believe that if this were a substantive prosecution, there would be no venue.
Correct.
All right.
Your Honors, as I said earlier, the defendant did not waive that issue. It's a plain error issue that can be brought before this court at any time. I know that I did not write a reply brief on this issue. This is case law that recently came to me before this hearing. But, Your Honors, if I may retreat back to my other argument with regards to the Rivera case as well, just to shore this up, with regards to the substantive issue, the mutual trust issue between these two individuals, one of the arguments that the officer testified to, or one of the portions of evidence, was that the buyer, Mr. Wilson, had my client's cell phone memorized. Well, anybody who receives a call can put that phone number in their ID or into their memory bank. That's not dispositive of trust. First name basis is not dispositive of trust. It's not a first and last name basis. It's a first name basis. Dale, Zach. None of these are sufficient nexuses to establish a level of mutual trust between the parties to reach the conclusion that Mr. Sanders was involved in a conspiracy with him. And again, Your Honors, Mr. Sanders did not care one iota what Mr. Wilson did with the drugs. The drugs were purchased in Louisville, Kentucky. Mr. Sanders never came to Indiana for any of these transactions. Mr. Wilson came to him in Louisville. Mr. Sanders sold him what he asked for. He received the money. It was over with. Your Honors, I never negated it at trial that Dale Sanders is a drug dealer, but he's not an individual subject to the jurisdiction of the Southern District of Indiana. And with that, Your Honors, I will save the remainder of my time for rebuttal if there are no further questions.
Certainly, Mr. Walton. Mr. Brookman.
Yes, sir. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Matt Brookman. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Evansville office in the Southern District of Indiana. I'm here asking you to affirm the conviction on Mr. Sanders in this case. As the court, I think, accurately pointed out, the facts in this case at the bench trial were essentially uncontroverted. The parties agreed everything that had happened. Basically, there was the defendant didn't contest anything.
What is your answer to my question to Mr. Walton? Why is this case being prosecuted as a conspiracy?
Why is it being prosecuted as a conspiracy? Because there was a conspiracy.
Look, the substantive offense and the conspiracy have identical penalties, but the proof of the substantive offense is a subset of the proof of the conspiracy. This is a slam dunk if prosecuted as a substantive crime, and a difficult case if prosecuted as a conspiracy. I assume that you're sane, and therefore that you haven't prosecuted it as a conspiracy, taking an extra burden without some reason. I'm asking what that reason is.
Well, I can answer that, Judge. I would argue that it's not a slam dunk as a possession with intent to distribute or a distribution at the hotel, which is essentially the act that occurred in Louisville. The pills that were found at the hotel were never found in Mr. Sanders' possession. He had stashed the pills at one location and had met with his buyers, or with Mr. Wilson, in the car outside that location. If it would have been charged in Louisville, if the Western District of Kentucky would have picked up this case and charged Mr. Sanders, my guess is that they would have charged him with a possession with intent to distribute ecstasy, because there was an actual distribution never actually occurred. It was a buy bust situation, and Wilson never received the pills before the police stepped in. They would have charged him with a possession with intent to distribute ecstasy. They would have faced the burden of the fact at trial that Mr. Sanders never had the pills on his person, that the transaction didn't go through. They may have had evidentiary problems with a lot of the 404B evidence or the other evidence of the conspiracy. I would respectfully submit that the stronger case was the conspiracy case.
Why? The evidence should be identical.
It should, Judge, if the district court in Louisville allows all of the evidence in of the conspiracy. But that's never a...
The court is obliged to.
Well, I can tell you that...
There are two problems here. One problem is potential venue problem. And the other problem is that you seem to think that co-conspirator hearsay is admissible only if a conspiracy is charged in the indictment. That's not true.
No, I don't believe that. I don't believe that's true. I just believe that if you're dealing with a possession with intent to distribute on a single occasion, your latitude as far as the evidence that you can get in may be significantly curtailed as opposed to charging a conspiracy.
No, the evidence is identical. That's the point I just made.
That may be accurate, but my experience with trying cases like this is that sometimes that's not the case at trial, that you are much more limited in the evidence that you're able to get in a possession with intent to distribute single count case as opposed to a conspiracy case. I think that's why the conspiracy case law developed, is because of the evidentiary issues. But the fact of the matter is that this case could have been was legally brought, and there was a crime committed in both districts. Mr. Sanders distributed the ecstasy in Louisville in the Western District of Kentucky. The people he was supplying and his distributors were distributing it in Evansville, Indiana, and traveling through New Albany, Indiana. The conspiracy stretched across the border, across the Ohio River. We have half the conspiracies that I charge in Evansville, Indiana, cross one border or another, either into Kentucky or into Illinois. That's the nature of the business when you work in a border area like Evansville, Indiana. So I think the case could be brought in either location. I can tell you that as a practical matter, the case was investigated by the Evansville DEA, and that probably had some basis in why it was presented to our office for prosecution as opposed to the Western District of Kentucky. But I think the bottom line answer is that it could have been brought at either location, and it was just as legally valid in either court.
Is it a conspiracy in either venue?
I believe they could have charged a conspiracy in Louisville also.
What about distribution without the conspiracy? Could that have been charged either place?
I don't believe we could have charged him with the final possession with intent to distribute that occurred in Louisville without a conspiracy. No, I don't believe we could have charged that count by ourselves. That venue would only lie in Louisville for that count. I think, as the court noted at the beginning of this case, this was a bench trial. Judge Young had a number of factors in front of him that suggested a conspiracy as opposed to a buy-sell relationship. Judge Young found the district court found a number of those factors, and that finding by the court is given great deference. For the appellant to win in this case, my understanding is he would have to show this court that the district court was devoid of any factors to base its finding of a conspiracy on, and that simply was not the case. The Rivera case, I would suggest to the court, is not analogous to the present facts at all. Mr. Hardin, who went to in his relationship with Mr. Rivera in California, first off was four transactions over a three-month time period. The case now at bar is 10 to 15 transactions over a 6 or 7 month time period. Mr. Hardin never knew Mr. Rivera when he first went to California to conduct the first transaction. Mr. Hardin didn't even go to California He sent other people for the second transaction and didn't even know when he sent those people that the second transaction would occur with Mr. Rivera, but rather that his middleman in California was going to be procuring some cocaine for him. We did not have evidence of fronting. In the Stott case is kind of the big case on fronting and proving a conspiracy, but fronting is not dispositive. We did have, in this case, evidence of what people have called a volume discount, and that is the more pills you buy, the cheaper the per-pill price becomes. And what that shows, I would suggest to the court...
Also true if you order wine from the best Indiana vineyards. If you order one bottle, you pay a higher price per bottle than if you order a case. Does that mean that if I order a case of wine from one of the great Indiana vineyards, I have committed a conspiracy with the vineyard?
If they make distributing wine illegal and you start ordering that wine in lots of in high volume so you can resell that wine, and your supplier, the vineyard, knows that you are buying it to resell it in Illinois, and the vineyard encourages you and would like you to buy more and more and more of that wine, and to encourage you to buy more and more wine gives you a cheaper price the more you buy.
The question that I asked.
It's apples and oranges, Judge, because one's illegal and one's not. But yes, if it was illegal, you would be a conspirator.
It's either a conspiracy or it isn't. The conspiracy may be illegal or not. Conspiracy is just an agreement.
To commit an illegal act.
Agreement to enter into a future transaction. I'm trying to understand why, in your view, a quantity discount demonstrates an agreement to enter into a future transaction. I gave the wine example because buying a case and getting a quantity discount doesn't remotely demonstrate a willingness to enter into a future transaction.
Not by itself.
So why does it demonstrate such a willingness here?
Because these aren't businessmen in the sense of valid businessmen. These are people who are conducting transactions with friends.
Businessmen.
Well, you're right, but I mean, they're not registered with the state. They don't conduct legal business. They absolutely want to encourage you to buy more of their product, and so that you can sell it and make more money for them. It's just one factor, Judge. I wouldn't put an entire conspiracy on the volume discount. But I wouldn't put an entire conspiracy on fronting either, although the Stott case says that may be that fronting alone may support a conspiracy. But my point on the volume discount is that it's essentially no different than fronting. Both of them are a way for the supplier.
I'm totally flummoxed by that. I mean, that indicates that you either don't understand fronting or you don't understand discounts.
But
fronting is a loan. It makes the person lending the drugs the business partner of the person who's reselling them. The quantity discount doesn't do that.
No, but Judge, they both...
The Indiana Vineyard, in my example, is not becoming my business partner when it sells me a case of wine for cash.
No, but both practice, Judge, encourages is the seller encouraging the buyer to buy more of their product and enabling the buyer to in turn resell that product. But any way that I can get more product cheaper or more product where I don't have the money to buy it allows me to go out and in turn resell it.
Everything you're saying makes me more skeptical about this case.
I'm doing a bad job then.
You don't have a theory that you're just throwing some mud against the wall and you hope some of it will be interpreted as a conspiracy. But you aren't trying to relate any of this to the definition of a conspiracy.
Judge, what I'm trying to do is go through the factors that this court has outlined in the Rivera case and in the other cases. And what I'm trying to show this court is that all we can go by at the trial level are the factors that you all set down for us. And you go through those factors, and if you have a lot of those factors, then I think it supports a conspiracy. I know in my own mind that these men were conspirators. I know that they were not arm's-length businessmen conducting a transaction. They were friends. They were on a first-name basis. They would conduct business at their home.
Counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
Anything further, Mr. Walden?
No, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Walden. We appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment and the assistance you've been both your client and the court. The case is taken under advisement.